Hello everyone and welcome to Sportspiel. After a week's absence, we are back with episode 7, and what can I say? While the wait may have been lengthy, it is nothing compared to the wait experienced by Doctor Who fan obsessives, who took over Twitter to express their outrage that they were forced to watch Sue Barker and company talk about tennis, rather than getting to the point and announcing who the 13th Doctor was going to be. Of course, while newly appointed Time Lord Jodie Whittaker is set to be very busy, she was by no means the busiest Doctor on Wimbledon Men's Final Day, because of that award goes to the man that had to treat Marin Cilic's badly blistered foot. And as the Croat wept in pain, the televisual audience was left aghast as it was revealed Cilic is arguably the longest set of toes in sport. But don't worry, listeners, because we're here to settle and calm everyone right down with some pleasant sporting chat. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, as ever, is Mr. Will Moulton.
It's good to be back, isn't it? Apologies for the delay, you know, family holidays and all that.
Yeah, how was the holiday anyway?
Loved it. I got sunburned. I mean, suntanned.
Tan.
I also conducted an interview for the podcast that's due to come out in 2 weeks' time, so...
Yes.
It's not like I wasn't actually doing work.
It was, yeah. That's good to see. You're still working away.
Of course.
While on holiday.
It's on the subject of Marin Cilic's feet, by the way. I once did cheerleading with a guy who had size 14 feet, so I think he'll give him a run for his money.
Well, I also think I'm in there for the running as well, because I have unusually large toes.
Thanks.
So I share that personal piece of information out there.
I didn't know that, and my life has not really been enhanced by knowing.
In our discussion section in this episode, we will talk about the Formula One British Grand Prix, which has been thrown into doubt recently. Next up on the agenda is the World Para Athletics, because myself and Will got to go on the Saturday, and a past feature interview guest on this podcast did quite well. And lastly, a story that perhaps typifies the highs and lows of sport rather spectacularly is the England cricket team, who have just suffered a crushing defeat to South Africa. In our second segment, our feature interview section, we have short track speed skater Charlotte Gilmartin as our guest. So stick around to listen about her sport, competing at the Sochi Winter Olympics, and her preparation for the upcoming 2018 Olympic qualifiers, which are just 11 weeks away. All that and more on Sportspiel. Well, on to the first topic of discussion today, and we're going to dive right in to Formula One and the British Grand Prix, because that took place this past weekend. But the competitive action was pushed to the side somewhat in the lead-up to the Grand Prix, because off-track politics took over as the owners of the Silverstone racetrack announced they would be activating the break clause in the contract, meaning that the last Grand Prix is scheduled to be in 2019. The owners said their decision was based on the fact that, despite sell-out crowds, they were continuing to lose money by hosting the race. The decision also comes amid murmurings of a possible London Grand Prix. But the first question I suppose we should dive into is, will 2019 be the last British Grand Prix at Silverstone?
At the moment, yes, it does look like this could be the last British Grand Prix, but the fact that they've cancelled the contract means that the British Racing Drivers Club, the BRDC, can go back to Chase Carey and Virgin Media and renegotiate the contract and potentially get it on a cheaper deal. So it's not the end of the line as such, but at the moment, yeah, it's looking like there may not be a British Grand Prix at Silverstone anymore, which is a shame because they always bring in a profit. The crowd's fantastic. It's not just Lewis Hamilton that says that. All the drivers say it. It's 120,000 on race day. It's a great atmosphere, and considering how inaccessible Silverstone is, I've been fortunate enough to go there and cover a couple of meets myself, and it's a nightmare to get to. So it's incredible that they managed to get that crowd, and that just shows how good a racetrack it is. Obviously, it's been a few years since that contract was signed, but there have always been rumours, oh, it's no longer going to be at Silverstone. Silverstone's always come up with the goods, but this time they've actually taken action, so it's not looking positive, but there's still hope. Let's hope they can renegotiate something, some good terms, and get it back to, you know, one of its spiritual homes. It might not have started there, but Formula One is... Silverstone is etched in Formula One history, and it needs to stay there.
But as was mentioned, the contract itself, and if you're speaking purely numbers, in a numbers sense. It's one of the cheaper contracts out there, but as has been mentioned, the British Grand Prix is one of the very few now on the Formula One calendar that doesn't receive government funding. Is that then perhaps the main problem for the British Grand Prix's future at Silverstone? Does the government actually need to put an injection of cash in?
Well, if you look at what the cost has been, so when in 2012 it cost 12 million, 2010 sorry, it cost £12 million to host the race. It goes up 5% annually. So this year it was 16.9 million. By 2027, when the contract was due to end, it was going to be 27.5 million. And in comparison to the likes of the Russian and the Azerbaijani Grand Prix, that's half, a third of the price. But in this country, with the government we've got in, the way the finances are going in this country, you're not going to get government backing, are you? As much as we want it, we're not going to.
That should also be pointed out that it's extremely unlikely right now with the present government. But I mention that because a possible alternative that has been mentioned quite frequently now is having a London Grand Prix. And a number of locations have been, you know, mentioned as possible race locations, and the Docklands is an option, the Olympic Park is an option. Formula E, of course, has had its Battersea Park race as well. And I remember reading that there's a company out there that had this grand idea of hosting a race in the Olympic Park and having a concert, a music venue, and making this big sort of festival to go alongside it. But crucially, they say they can bring all that in, operate at a profit, and they don't need government funding. Is that actually seen as a possibility? Will there be a London Grand Prix?
I mean, that sounds impressive. That sounds seriously, seriously impressive and financially viable, which is just the main issue here. Formula One is an expensive sport. Unfortunately, it's the logistics here that I think are going to stop them, because Bernie Eccleston first moved to the idea of a London Grand Prix based around the Olympic Park 4, 5, 6 years ago. And that's never come to light because you can't shut down the centre of London for a day. You can do it with Monaco, quite a small, fairly quiet principality. London, all the hustle and bustle. You can do it for a marathon, maybe for a day or two. But with a Formula One race, it's not just the 3 days of on-track action. It's the week before to get all the track set up. Probably even 2 weeks before. It's the week after for taking all the stuff down. You're closing the centre of London for 2 or 3 weeks.
I can't see how it is viable, and anyone that suggested it was at all possible to hold a race right in the centre of the city, one of the world's busiest cities, I can't see it happening.
It would be incredible. It would be absolutely fantastic to see Formula One cars in the Olympic Park. I don't know where in the Olympic Park though, but it would be great. It's just, I can't see it happening.
No, I don't think so. But onto the race itself. And it turned out to be the perfect weekend for Mercedes with a 1-2. Lewis Hamilton came first and Valtteri Bottas came second after clawing his way back after his grid penalty. Not so good for Ferrari with Kimi Raikkonen finishing third, but Sebastian Vettel ended up limping home quite literally in seventh. Both the Ferrari drivers had blowouts of their tyres coming in within the last 2 laps of the race, which is essentially why Vettel finished where he was. But should they have known that they were in blowout danger zone? Or, as I think, was it just a stroke of luck, really?
We'd seen on our screens in the laps leading up to it, on the Ferraris especially, but also a number of other cars, that there was blistering on the left front tyre. And for those who might not be in the know, basically blistering is when sort of rubber is coming away from the surface in a certain pattern. And the worst possible scenario that could happen is the tyre delaminates. So the tyre structure stays in place, but the rubber just literally rips off. And that's exactly what happened with Raikkonen. So it wasn't a puncture. It wasn't caused by some debris or anything. It was a case of the blistering turned into this delamination that caused the tyre to shred itself. So the carcass was still intact, but the rubber came off. As soon as that happened to Raikkonen, they should have brought Vettel in. Raikkonen said the tyres were seen fine. The data seemed okay. So perhaps they weren't to know with him. And the, you know, Hülkenberg earlier in the race had done loads of laps, more laps than the Ferraris did on a similar tyre. So there wasn't anything necessary to suggest that Raikkonen should have come in. But as soon as that happened, Ferrari should have responded and brought Sebastian Vettel in. Red Bull did with Max Verstappen, and he ended up coming fourth. Ferrari didn't, and they lost out. And I think at the halfway stage in the season, if something like that happens to your teammate, if it happened to Vettel first, then I could, you know, fair enough. But the fact is, Vettel's in the championship title hunt. He needs, at this stage, all the points he can get. We've seen that Nico Rosberg last year got all the points he could possibly get at the start of the season. Then when Hamilton came back into form at the end, you know, he could hold on for that victory. This time round, I think what Ferrari needed to do was just play the safe card, bring him in, secure third or fourth, whatever he was going to get, and secure the points. You'd have a bigger lead, because it's only halfway. We've still got another 11 races to go.
This is where I mildly disagree with you, in that I think sport is often about he who dares wins. And I think to bring him in with two laps remaining for something that may have happened, might have happened, would have looked like a ridiculous move with the benefit of hindsight. But now that we've seen his tyres did go and he ended up finishing seventh, now we can all sort of jump on that and criticise that decision. But I think if his tyres had hung on for another lap or two, it would have been a brilliant move, because he would have got third and he would still have maintained some sort of championship lead over Lewis Hamilton.
I guess we'll just have to agree to disagree, but whatever, what's happened has happened now. We're halfway through the season. It's 1 point between the top two drivers. We've got Valtteri Bottas in the mix as well. I think this is what Formula 1 needed. And that race did need a bit of drama at the end, because what started off as a great race was getting boring. So the Ferraris actually did us a favour as spectators.
Yeah, in that regard, yes, they did. And as you say, it's very tight at the top now, with Vettel on 177 points and Lewis Hamilton second on 176. Bottas is on 154. But we'll move on to topic number two of the sports discussion section, and that is the World Para Athletics Championships, which began on Friday the 14th of July and will go on until the 23rd of July. Now, Britain are currently third in the medal table with 11 golds, 2 silvers and 7 bronze medals, which is behind China, who are currently first, and the USA in second. Our gold medalists so far are Hannah Cockcroft, who's got 2, Sophie Camlish, Olivia Breen, Johnny Peacock, Alec Davis, Sophie Hahn, Richard Whitehead, Holly Arnold, Steph Reed, and of course, friend of the show, and our guest on the last episode, Sammy Kinghorn. Now, we are big fans of our show. We like to admit our bias there. And as per, we're going to focus on our one-time guest, who took gold in the T53 200 metres in a world record time. And we're lucky enough to say that we were both there in the stadium to watch it.
We were. What and that Saturday evening as well, second of the championships, we were treated. We saw 8 medals for GB, 4 of which were gold. We saw Richard Whitehead and Holly Arnold win gold within 30 seconds of each other. We saw 6 world records broken. The first world record we saw broken was in 3 minutes and 30 seconds.
Yeah, was it that long?
It was 3 minutes
and 30
seconds.
Literally, as soon as we sat down, boom, world record.
it was the second guy in the shop at the Malaysian. It was a great night, and it was fantastic to see Sammy. I don't know about you, but when I was sitting there, I was really, really nervous. I don't know why.
Tell me about it, I noticed.
I sort of got a bit emotionally interested, I guess, which I don't normally admit to, but it was fantastic to see Sammy. And, you know, seeing her afterwards, she was so overwhelmed, so elated. She's finally got that big... She's got 3 European golds before and a world bronze, but she didn't win anything at the Paralympics. She never won a world para-athletic gold. So to see her do that was fantastic. And I actually went back to the stadium the next night, and on my way in, I passed her on the way out. I really wanted to go and say hello, but I decided not to because she looked fairly flustered. And I think she's just, you know, all the attention and everything. I think she's loving it, but I think it's also quite new to her. So by the time this goes out, she might well have won another medal.
And another world record in that time as
well,
quite possibly.
And then 2 more events on Sunday. So we wish Sammy all the best. And I think we're glad we sort of uncovered a little gem there between us.
Absolutely. And going on to another one of that evening's gold medal stars, and that's Richard Whitehead, who's just celebrated his 41st birthday. The good news is he's announced he's not retiring, but he also might not be able to compete in the T42 100 metres now. Why is that?
Well, it's no mite about it. It's definitely not, because the International Paralympic Committee have said double leg amputee runners can't compete in that event. And they've said that is because they want to create a stronger depth of competition and a stronger overall competition. Yet, by taking Richard Whitehead away, there are no other real sort of double-leg amputees he can race against, maybe apart from Dave Henson, that are in his class. And he's not going to be able to race, and there isn't a category for him anymore. So surely that's weakening the competition for the likes of Scott Reardon. And as Whitehead came out and said, you know, it's playing with his career. He's a he's a professional athlete, and yeah, he's doing the 200 metres, but previously he wasn't allowed to do the 400 metres because of safety concerns. And again, safety's been cited here by Scott Reardon, who is the 100 metre T42 champion. Richard White has come out and said that's a load of rubbish. He's never clipped anyone. You know, you can see in the race he's nowhere near any of the other runners. He does have a wide swing, but it's not outrageous. He's not going to hit anyone. And he says, you know, it's isolating individuals. And Whitehead was really, he said, you know, we need the IPC, we need to, they need to be inclusive. They need to allow all disabled people to compete in some way and not, you know, they're sort of, it's almost like discriminating against him because he's got two legs missing rather than one. It's a bit ridiculous, really, and it's a shame.
It's always one of the more frustrating things I see when I read stories like this, when an athlete's career has been significantly altered for the worst by decisions of people at the top, at the administrative level, and it forever annoys me that things like that can happen. And of course, there's another, you know, classification debate going on at the moment with regards to Hannah Cockcroft, another star of these games, who she's got two medals already, could have another a third one by the time the championships finish. But it's the debate that's going on at the moment is whether you classify by times or disability. But how is that going to affect her?
So at the moment, she's competing in a field, and at the world, she's competing against 4 or 5 other athletes per race. Next year at the Euros, due to be held in Berlin, there's the possibility that she'll have no races because there's no real competition. You've got Carrie Denigan, you've got Carly Tate, Brits, Joyce Lefebvre of Belgium could be competing against her, but they're nowhere near her. And then you've got the closest challenger she's got is Alexa Halko, but she's American, so obviously she won't be at the Euros. And it's a case of Cockcroft is so far ahead of everyone else with the same sort of disability, with the same sort of issues. No one else is catching her up. It's now a case of we can't let one of the poster girls of not just British parasports, but worldwide parasports, the fact that she might not have a race in one of the major competitions sounds is ridiculous. And looking at her time, she's improving all the time, setting world records all the time. I was comparing her to the T53 and T54 athletes, so that is the likes of Sammy Kinghorn, Tatiana McFadden. She's not far off them, and they're different disabilities. You know, they've got Hannah Cockcroft's got cerebral palsy, whereas these girls have got no leg function and different disabilities. But she's catching up to them. She's setting similar-ish times in certain areas. Why shouldn't she be allowed to therefore compete with people that she could actually have a good race with? Rather, it's fantastic to see her win gold, but I think she's going to get bored, and we don't want her to move away from the sport. We want her to be competing against the best, and I don't see why. It's being done now on disability when you've got so many athletes. It's a case of now we've got so many athletes where you can now go on the times rather than the disability, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
Well, yeah, exactly. But it would make for a greater spectacle, I think, as we both said on Saturday. We were watching all the events and you could see 2 or 3 people who are miles ahead of the rest of the field. Regardless of sport, it happens to quite a few of them. And we saw with Oscar Pistorius, who, of course, his times were so good, he was allowed to compete at the Able-Bodied Olympics. Of course, his career has gone terribly wrong since then, but that was a prime example. If you're good enough and you're setting those times, why not be given the chance to actually challenge yourself against that quality of opposition?
Exactly. I think in certain ways you're going to get athletes who are just that far ahead of everyone. So you have Marcus Rey, the long jumper. He's jumping the same distance as Olympic athletes. No one else is coming close to him in any classification. But we saw Holly Arnold and the Kiwi girl. They had a really good ding-dong battle for gold in the F42 javelin. They should, I think, be allowed to compete with people who therefore maybe a classification up, make it harder for them, but throwing slightly different distances because, again, they're improving all the time, but they're so far ahead of everyone else.
Oh yeah,
we were watching. It was a two-horse race, wasn't it? The other girls were 15, 16 meters behind. It was
exactly
ridiculous.
But we'll move on now to our final topic of discussion today, and that is cricket, a sport I know lots and lots about. Which obviously, if you know me, you know that's complete rubbish. Now it all started so well for England's new Test captain Joe Root, with a dominant win over South Africa in the first Test. They won by 211 runs. But everything came crashing back down to earth when they were royally destroyed by South Africa in the second test by 340 runs. Now, I suppose a lot of criticism obviously come the way of the England team after that defeat. But the first point that I want to talk about is something that came from BBC Sports' Jonathan Agnew, where he criticised England's champagne cricketers in that when they're good, it can look very showy, it can look very impressive, and it can come off spectacularly. But when they're not quite on song, it fails in a dramatic way.
Oh, it certainly does, and I completely agree with him. And this is aimed, actually, there's sort of two sort of banks of criticism that have been going out here. The first bank is at the champagne players, and the second bank is at the sort of the players who are struggling to perform. But we'll go to the champagne players. So he's really directing this at Ben Stokes, Johnny Bairstow, Moeen Ali, even to a point Joe Root. They all come out, they all play flashy cricket, high tempo, aggressive, but they can't adapt to a situation. Joe Root came out in that second innings, in the first innings when England was struggling, and put out a decent score of 78, but it was a high tempo and he had a few chances. He got done by a fantastic ball in the second innings, but Stokes, Bairstow, Ali, I don't know what Bairstow was doing in that second innings. He was sort of flashing at everything, and in the first innings flashing at everything, and the situation that England found themselves in didn't require that, especially in the first innings. Bairstow came in, England was sort of they were not massively struggling, but they were sort of at a bit of a wobbly stage where they needed him to show a bit of grip, which he has. He's a fantastic player, Bairstow, and he's shown that before. But he just came out, all he wanted to do was whack everything. He was edging things. He got to 45 somehow. Stokes and Moeen Ali in the second innings as well, when England needed to try and show some resilience. Stokes got out trying to play a straight drive. A straight drive's a fantastic shot if you can play it, but that wasn't the time or the place or the ball. And Moeen Ali in the second innings again, the game is gone by this point, but trying to play a big lap sweep through leg side and hitting it straight to the fielder. I completely agree with what Agger says. And then Graham Smith came out the other day and said, if your players cannot adapt to a situation, he wouldn't pick them. Strong words. You can't imagine this England side without Stokes and Bairstow and Moeen. But he has a point. You have to have these champagne players have to be able to pull it out of the bag at all times in all situations. Not all of the time, but they have to be able to do it whatever the situation is given, not just when England are on top and it's a batting friendly wicket.
Adaptable, really.
Yeah.
And one other thing that I found quite striking out of all of this is Trevor Bayliss, England's head coach, who has been since 2015. He defers selection decisions to other individuals because he hardly ever watches county cricket. So essentially he approves the selection of players he has never seen play with his own eyes. And that strikes me as something particularly balmy for a major international cricket team.
Yeah, I wasn't actually aware of this until you mentioned it to me earlier today. And that's ridiculous. I mean, he's obviously got good coaches and good scouts that he sends out. So he'll send out the likes of, you know, Gus Fraser, who's Middlesex director of cricket as well. So he'll be getting updates from him on the Middlesex guys. He'll send out Mark Ramprakash or someone, Graham Gooch. But you need to see someone for yourself because everyone has their own opinion. And Keaton Jennings is an example. Obviously, someone has spotted him. He had a great season for Durham. He's come in and he did get that debut Test 100, but he has a massive technical deficiency on the front foot. And that's something that if Trevor Bayliss had seen for himself, would he have picked him? So I think that's ridiculous. It's worked to a point. England have done okay in Test cricket, done fantastic in one day cricket, done okay in Test cricket over the last few years, but to have a coach that doesn't actually go out and do that is ridiculous.
Strikes me as another big issue that they really have to sort out if they're actually going to overcome their inconsistency at the moment.
Yeah.
But away from the men's side, and we're going to go on to the women's side now, which is a far more positive story at the moment.
It is.
In that the Women's World Cup is currently ongoing in this country right now, and the England team have made it to the final.
Yes.
Which will be on Sunday at a sold-out Lord's. They're going to play either Australia or India. Their semi-final hasn't happened yet, but by the time you've listened to this, you'll know who England will be facing. Now, with the coverage that the World Cup has been getting on Sky and the performance of the team itself, it strikes me as a fantastic advert for English women's cricket, really. And people are starting to take notice.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's a shame it's not on terrestrial TV. I have my own, obviously, my own opinions about that. But Sky, from what I've seen, done a good job. And the girls have been fantastic. They've obviously not engaged with their fans as much because they've sort of followed what England Hockey did. They've not really been on Twitter or Instagram that much. But, you know, they've done this sort of players go boldly stuff that is sort of tour diary, which has been fantastic. And the girls have played some really entertaining and attractive cricket. One thing that Mark Robinson did in 2015 was to take the staleness out of the England team and actually make them play aggressive, attacking cricket, like what happened with the men. And interesting to know that actually potentially getting rid of Charlotte Edwards has actually been the best thing for England cricket, because they've not just relied on her. She's a fantastic player, and she was sort of forced into retirement because I think Mark Robinson realised that other players were relying on her too much, and England weren't scoring above 250 in any game. It was the game against South Africa, where they were struggling 12 to 18 months ago, they would have lost because no one was performing. But now you've got Lauren Winfield, Tammy Beaumont, Sarah Taylor, Heather Knight, Fran Wilson, Nat Siver, Danny Wyatt scoring runs for fun. You've got the bowlers taking wickets. Everyone is stepping up. No one is too reliant on anyone anymore. So England the other day in that semi-final against South Africa, all their big guns went. Taylor got 50-odd, Knight got 30-odd, Siver got none, Lauren Winfield didn't get many, Tammy Beaumont didn't get many. But then it was Fran Wilson who came in batting at six alongside Jenny Gunn and saw England through. They weren't relying on the big players. They knew they had to come in and do it themselves. We'll take Fran Wilson to scoop aside when she got herself out. But apart from that, she played a fantastic innings, and it's great to see England playing such fantastic cricket. The coverage on, as you say, on Sky, on the BBC radio has been immense. I hope it's a real turning point for cricket in this country. There's a push now to get more kids involved with the ECB's All-Stars programme. The women's aspects has certainly been very, very positive at the moment, which is fantastic. And let's hope they can add to that by winning their first major final since 2009 on Sunday.
Seems to be a great, you know, that's the marker of any successful team, when every member of that squad is chipping in and contributing. But that concludes this first segment on this episode of the Sports Spiel. But stick around, because after the break, we have our feature interview section with short track speed skater Charlotte Gilmartin. So stick around to hear about her sport, competing at the Sochi Olympics, and her preparation that is going on for the upcoming Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. Welcome back, everyone, to the feature interview segment. We are delighted to be joined by a Winter Olympian. After competing at the 2014 Sochi Games, this person will be eyeing up further success at the upcoming Pyeongchang Games, just over 6 months away now. She's enjoyed a positive 2017 with the European bronze medal, and by my reckoning, four British titles coming her way. It's a very warm welcome to short track speed skater Charlotte Gilmartin. Charlotte, thanks very much for speaking with us. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. So yeah, I'm in a good place at the moment.
That's always good. Now, as we often like to do in this section, we like to find out how an athlete initially got into their respective sport, and yours is certainly quite an interesting starting point, because I believe you were initially scouted at a friend's 13th birthday party. How did that all come about?
Yeah, exactly that, really. So I've been on the ice, like a little session on a Friday night when you go down to the disco, like twice before this. I'd had like some skating skills just because I'd come from roller hockey when I was younger, just kind of battling against my brother. So I could skate, I just couldn't stop, so it'd either be the floor or the barrier that was going to stand still at this party. But I've always been super competitive, so I was actually racing my friend Sam, as a brother, around the track, like during the party. And like I say, there's not many skills other than just being able to get to speed. And then one of the guys, Joe New, who worked at the ice rink and was a big part of the club and skated previously, and so his daughter, so he kind of came over, he was sort of scouted me out and said, no, have you ever considered short track? And I'd never heard of it before, but I was intrigued to kind of give it a go. I think the main thing you've seen in me was the lack of fear, possibly. I've just kind of given it a go and not kind of taking any knocks at the falls, and really enjoying it. So I went down that Friday. They kind of gave me some free skates to try out. And literally, I fell in love. I just never looked back. So I was a part of the Molex team in Solihull for the next... I joined the national team 2 years later. So it's literally 3 years later, maybe. It's just an absolute rollercoaster, but yeah.
Yeah, and it certainly sounds like there was definitely some natural talent there, and that probably lack of fear is quite a good attribute to have when you're, you know, crashing into barriers and whatnot. And when you actually sit down and watch the sport, you know, the pace of it, I think reach up to 35 miles an hour, and the precarious nature of it makes it an exhilarating thing to watch. But is that the same sort of feeling you get when you take part in it? And is that kind of what got you hooked in the first place?
Yeah, I think it is a really exciting sport, and obviously you're on like a blade that's 17 inches long, it's only a millimetre thick, so you're able to carve into the ice and kind of get that real feel for the speed coming through the corner. And obviously at first it wasn't as fast as it is now, but yeah, you can still kind of feel like you're on the edge of your like tipping point, and that's where I think at that point I love that feeling. And I think, yeah, people that would get into the sport, and I think if you're kind of happy to push your limits and push yourself to the edge, it's definitely the sport for you. But yeah, like at the moment, we've been going each season, getting faster and faster. And Elise Christie, my teammate, she became the world record holder in the 500 metres. So literally in the UK, we have the fastest ever skated for the female 500 metres. So yeah, it's really great.
Yeah, it seems to be going in, you know, the perfect pathway at the moment. And we'll come on to the Sochi Games in a moment, but how early on in your career did reaching a Winter Olympics become a main goal for you?
So when I was really young, I didn't really follow the Olympics. I think most Olympians do, and that was like just big inspiration. For me, it was very much that I just loved playing sport. I was not interested in watching anything, but just anything that felt like a competition, whether it was like a game of Monopoly or a 500-meter race. Like, I just wanted to win, and I found so much enjoyment in that. So yeah, and it took, I think, at 15 years old, I managed to join the national team, and which was a really big step, but not only for myself, but like my mum too, like allowing me to kind of leave home so young to move to Nottingham to kind of in the pursuit of this dream. And I think it was at that point where I kind of went to my first World Cup at the age of 17, 2 years later, and like reality struck that I'd done star classes, which is like the younger events, and had gained quite a few medals, and it's like, actually, this is the World Cup now. It wasn't so easy, and if I wanted to do this, the hard work had to start here. And from that point, it's like, the eyes were on the prize, and yeah, just putting in the work and the effort and being patient, because nothing ever comes easy if it's worth having, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, how much of a challenge then was it to put in that extra effort and find that extra gear so that you could qualify for Sochi?
Yeah, so I'd previously tried to qualify for Vancouver, and with how the qualification works, it's all quite tricky, and I basically just missed out as the next girl not to go from Team GB short track. So I think that really put a taste in my mouth of, you know, needing, like, wanting it even more. So when Sochi came round, you know, I'd put in, at this point it's like an 8-year cycle rather than 4 years, like, this has got to be the one. And, you know, the days where you get up in the morning and, you know, your legs are aching, you can't really walk down the stairs, you're in pain, it's uncomfortable, my day hasn't even started yet.
Yeah.
So there's days like that where it's just like, and you're getting up and it's dark outside, your legs are killing, you're trying to get to the ring, but then you just, all you're thinking is like, you know, trying to bring yourself back to, but it's going to be worth it. And in short track, obviously, there are ups and downs and some unpredictabilities to the sport, so you can never guarantee anything. But yeah, making it to Sochi was a massive thing for me, because I'm missing out at Vancouver. Qualifying for Sochi, I actually got knocked over my first race, which was the 1500, my preferred distance. I had to get up, catch the race up, but then by the time it kicked off, I'd kind of already got too tired from having to accelerate, fall over, accelerate again, and I was in tears thinking, it's over, I've done it again, I'm just going to miss out, how can I qualify now? And and then I was sat outside, like, you know, getting upset, and then we have a big support team around us, psychologists, physios, and coaches, and they were kind of rallying around to make sure I could go back and, you know, keep trying to go out there and give whatever I had left. And that if it wasn't good, if it hopefully it was good enough on the day, but if it wasn't, I'd be proud if I'd left everything out there. Mm-hmm. So then went on to the next distance next, and by the end of it, I'd, after falling over and getting disqualified and things that had gone badly, pull myself back together, go out and put out some big performances to kind of weigh it back my way and qualify into two out of the three distances after over the two World Cups at the time. So making it to the Olympic Games was no easy task, but getting there was amazing to have that experience and get that kind of in the bag for this time round. So actually, that was about gaining the knowledge, experience, and what it's going to be like, and this time round I'm there to perform. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all the hard work certainly paid off, and the highs and lows that you went through. And looking away from a competitive side of things for the moment, when you arrived in Russia for the Games, what was it like for you to be involved and immersed in an event on as grand a scale as that, considering, you know, you're an athlete right at the centre of the mayhem?
Yeah, because I think coming from, especially from short track, it's not necessarily a major sport within our country. We don't send out that many Winter Olympians. So to kind of go from people not really knowing what short track is to feeling like, you know, the media's on, you've arrived at this like massive place where you've got huge dining halls, you can eat wherever you want, as much as you want, and big games rooms, and everyone's staying in the same little village, and you're there for a whole 4 months, like kind of secluded in this place. It was exciting, and it was very different to how our normal competition works. We do it every weekend, and suddenly do one day of racing, you have 5-6 days off and one more day of racing. So the whole Olympic environment was definitely strange to what I was used to, but the feeling of just being like I'd managed to make it there, mm-hmm. and okay, like I had setbacks, I'd got there, and just, I think the biggest thing was that feeling of relief almost. And that isn't how I expected to feel when I got there, but that relief of, okay, like, I'm here. It didn't go well getting here, but I've made it, and now it's about, actually, let's enjoy the experience, enjoy the racing, and I'll get the best out of myself if I can put myself in that position, because I almost went in as the underdog after qualifying.
Yeah, and with regards to the racing then, you take part in the 500 metres and 1500 metres, but was the main aim really to kind of get used to that environment and that level of quality competition so you could take it forward and improve later in the career?
Yeah, so realistically, I'd went into the Olympic season being consistently in the top 16 rankings within my sport. So, you know, anything can happen. I was hoping, you know, everyone was going to ask that goal, but at that time, I probably wasn't strong enough at that point to take that forward. So I was going there hoping that I could do something more, but knowing realistically I was finishing that kind of top 16 ranking, which I managed to do after the game, so I came away in 500 metres, finishing 16th. But yeah, this time round, after my last couple of seasons performances, I've been consecutive in the A finals and pushing for them medals and coming away with three after last year. This time round, I'm definitely more hungry and it feels even more closer, so I'm hoping I can make it happen.
Yeah, and fast forwarding now to the present, even it's been a pretty successful year for you, as I mentioned at the beginning. But you wrote a really interesting blog about bouncing back from your disappointment at the World Championships in March, an event that you described as, you know, the pinnacle of the season. You came away with two penalties, and you're out in the other event as well. And has that disappointment almost given you a renewed drive, and what lessons did you take out of that competition?
I think it's more just kind of understanding myself a bit more. So I'd obviously come off the back of two World Cup medals back to back in two World Cups, literally weeks before I travelled out to this World Championships, a European medal. So I'd gone in thinking, this is going to be my Worlds. I'm skating PBs and training days before it, so I've got this massive boost of confidence. I'm feeling great. My family were out there and they'd never come out to watch before for a World Championship. It literally couldn't have gone worse. I got to qualify in two distances, which I didn't necessarily agree with, and if you ever do, I was like, oh, I don't know, it was like a 50-50 call. And yeah, it came came away so disheartened. I think you can get hung up a little bit sometimes on the result of it, well, obviously. But I think what I tried to quickly turn back to the process, like I did do everything I could. I put myself out there in the races, which is why it became penalties and stuff, and I need to just keep committing. But I think the biggest learning curve was just to make sure I didn't put the pressure on. And I think every time I think, yeah, like, I need this, I have to do it, it can become too much in my mind. And it was the psychologist after that helped so much to actually, you know, it's just, it literally, at World Championships, it's one day that went wrong. Friday, you qualify. So Saturday and Sunday, it was already too late. So in one day, I messed up and all three distances were out. And it's just, you come back and you just think, I'm not good enough. I should have done more, I should have done this, should have done that. And actually, it's just like, it was one day, and just trying to be like, you know, bring myself back to work. It doesn't make me a bad skater or a bad person for not getting it right. And I think if I can get back to just enjoying the sport, because that's what I love. I love racing. Yeah, I'm so passionate about it, and I get a real thrill from being able to, you know, try and dominate races and tactically outwit people and feel like I'm on the edge of my seat almost, that, you know, you're so close to falling over but making so much speed at the same time. And I think it's just, if I can stay in that frame of mind of just enjoying what I do and enjoying the sport, then it all just seems to fall into place for me, because I'm relaxed, I skate with more, like, fluidity. So that's what I'm going to try and do this time around. And it's just, you know, I went to the last games and I need to not be, just be able to be less desperate, just make sure that I'm just getting the processes right and the rest to look after itself.
Yeah, and that's, you mentioned the sports psychology aspect a couple of times. How you know, important is that? And is that probably the biggest thing that you've got to train yourself to do, is to stop that self-doubt almost creeping in?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not there yet, and I'm in the pursuit of making that happen, just to have this robustness, I guess, that as an athlete is a big part of it. From any sport, you know, everyone that you're, when you're at elite level, everyone's training, everyone's pushing themselves every day. So physically, you're on a plane, almost on a playing field. The next two biggest things it comes down to is technical ability, so how quick you're learning and quick you're adapting. And then after that, it's all mental. Who can turn up and bring it on the day? Who can be at the right, you know, point of, you know, the not anxiety, but, you know, having everything under control where you're completely in the right space for that race. And I've definitely suffered from nerves a lot more in the past. I used to be on the start line and my whole bottom lip would just be juddering, chattering together just through nerves, and it looked like I'm freezing cold. But yeah, and I've managed to, like, get that under control now and, you know, push forward. And I think it's a massive part, the mental side of it, and just on a daily basis being able to push yourself is it. But also when you're racing, just now to give your optimum performance, and that's going to come down to whether you've got it right in your head more so than how your legs feel on that day.
Yeah, and that's a battle that I suppose any athlete, regardless of sport, can probably sympathise with, really. And with the 2018 Olympics fast approaching, how is then the qualifying preparation going for you? And what's the level of training that you're having to put in to be at your best right now?
Yeah, so we train together as a team in Nottingham. We train 5 to 6 days a week, 2 to 4 sessions a day. You're on the ice 2 to 4 hours a day. So that's a lot. And then on top of that, you've got, like, bid analysis, nutritionist, psychologist. So there is a lot of time and hours that go in, not just my own, but from the support staff around me and the great team we have. But also we're going out to Como in Italy this coming Sunday. Do a 3-week training camp, and that just takes that another level where you've got no distractions. You're in the middle of the mountains, you're literally getting up at 5 a.m, training for a couple of hours straight, coming back, eating, sleeping, repeating, and that's literally for 3 weeks. So hopefully getting some big gains there. And yeah, again, each season so far I've improved physically, but also in results, just chipping away at stepping forward. So I'm hoping that this is going to be the next level for me.
Yeah, and there's also an aim to qualify first ever British female relay team for the Olympics as well, which would include yourself and Elise Christie, who you mentioned. How much of an achievement would that be to get that team to Pyeongchang?
I'm so excited behind this team. It's the first time I've ever had a full girls team of six to go forward, and I think the female participation previously was just too low for them. There's always too many gaps between people retiring and joining the national team. And I've tried to qualify with previous teams the last two games. We finished ninth overall and top eight qualified. So to kind of fall at the very last hurdle, I'm hoping this time around we're in such a better position. And yeah, like with myself medlin, Elise Christie, world champion right now. And then you've got Kat, who's really pushing the semi-finals. And we've got, you know, three other girls that are putting in so much effort day in, day out right now. So we're in a good position. I'm excited to see if we can make this happen, because it'll be the first ever GB female relay team. So to kind of have achieved that, or just, it'll mean so much to me and the girls too. So, yeah, I'm optimistic, and I feel like we're stronger than we've ever been as a GB team. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Exactly. It'll be another, you know, testament to how the sport is improving and continuing to grow if that does happen. Now, on the short track website, it says that, I don't know if this is true, but it says that your motto is be patient and persistent, and that your hero is the champion himself, Roger Federer. Does a philosophy like that and having a sporting hero like that really inspire you to keep pushing? Is there anyone else out there that has helped drive you on when the going gets tough?
Yeah, so that is a motto. I think it's mostly because of the fact that as a person, non-skating wise, I'm pretty much the most impatient person you can meet. That's probably my biggest downfall. So within short track, and it's just, that's what I kind of learned over the year, that it is about, you know, you've got to be patient and persist and not let the little knocks make any difference. Just keep going in, with the processes and the goals and pushing forward. But more than anyone, SJ Lee, Sungjae Lee, he's my current coach. He came over from Korea 5 years ago now to coach us. I think he has like 60 World Cup medals. Like, it's crazy, phenomenal. But he kind of came over, and actually it was him that really changed my mindset and made me understand like technical things to move forward on. He literally sat me down and said, it's my goal to get you a World Cup medal this year, and the pressure's not on you, it's for me to get you there, to get you in the right place. And I think I'd never felt like I had that massive backing before, and for this guy that was obviously so successful within his career to say that this is what's going to happen, it was crazy. And then literally that was the year I got my first ever World Cup medal. So he really gave me self-belief, and like I say, moving forward technically is massive within our sport. And yeah, so he's still my current coach, and we're going to this Games this time round, hopefully with more success from that point forward.
Yeah, and it really helps having that extra person just to give you that extra bit of support when you need it most.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, one thing I wanted to touch upon was the UK sport funding. And our first ever podcast guest was James Andrew Davis, a two-time Olympic fencer. And shortly after Rio, UK sport withdrew their funding for fencing, which left him in the loop for the upcoming season. Thankfully, with short track speed skating, it's a different position, because at the end of last month it was announced that sport was getting an increase in funding of around £67,500, which makes that, I think, a total of around £4.7 million for this Olympic cycle. What I wanted to ask was, just how vitally important is it having that funding in order for you and, you know, teammates and other short track speed skaters to do as well as you possibly can?
Yeah, I literally just couldn't thank UK Sport enough to be in the position that we're in. And also, like, we get a lot of lottery funding, so everyone that's out there buying lottery tickets, you know, it's a big thank you for them, because we wouldn't be going on these training camps. We probably wouldn't have the ice time we have within the UK to train as a unit and a team together. To even the flights to get to Olympic qualifiers and all the stuff that adds up, it is the make or break of a team, having that backing and that funding from people. And that is why I think we've progressed so much, and like I say, within our team we've got so many medals and successes from last year. And for UK Sport to agree that this is going in the right direction, a lot of the funding that's really is also going towards the biggest change probably is the development side of short track. Previously, it's been very focused on the people at the top, where they're just trying to get them out, get their medals, because that's what, if we don't do that, we haven't got any funding. But now we're able to, with the amount of money we can get forward, it's able to actually start focus on the development so that there's not these big gaps that keep going where we're having an Olympian and then next year around we can't afford the class of people coming through, so then they drop out before they've got to their time. So we've now got this academy set up, Short Track Academy, which is hopefully just, we've took athletes from different sports, as well as like figure skating, ice hockey and things like that, to kind of test them to see if they'll be good at short track, and they're getting like scrutinised on making sure they've got certain aspects that we're looking for in a sport, and that just means that our sport's going to grow phenomenally more and keep getting stronger, and which is obviously going to help with funding because we'll be getting more results and then getting that backing to keep us going. So we literally couldn't thank them enough.
Exactly, it just emphasises how important that money really is to grow all sports in this country.
So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and what is it, 11 weeks there or thereabouts until the first qualifier?
Yes, that is correct. So, like I say, the countdown is on. At this point, we've been through the building phase. We've worked really hard in the gym, building up lean muscle mass on everyone. And then at this point now, it's just about getting used to, well, more critiquing like the race side of it and being at race pace and practicing overtaking, because obviously there's so many dynamics to the sport. So it's not that far from game time.
Exactly, the pressure I'm sure will start picking up in not that long time to go.
Yeah.
And well, we wish you the very best of luck as well for the upcoming qualifiers, and I suppose I better finish off by saying thank you once again for joining us and giving us a bit of an insight into your life, and you're a great speaker and an advocate of your sport and clearly a lovely person as well, so a big thank you for joining us on this episode.
Thank you so much for having me, and hopefully keep in touch soon.
Well, we'd just like to take this opportunity to thank Charlotte again for taking part in that interview. And we'd also like to point you in the direction of our social media pages. You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Instagram. That's SportSpielPod. And you can also email us feedback at sportspielpod@gmail.com.
We will be back in 2 weeks. In the meantime, don't forget to sort of, you know, tell your friends, tell your family, get people to listen. Even if you don't listen to us, just listen to the interviews. They're always great to, it's great to hear the athletes and sort of the human aspect of them. We'll be back in 2 weeks. I've already done my interview. Some of you may have seen the video of where I did the interview, on a nice cliff top or on a lovely sunny Cornish day. So that's one to look forward to, and we will see you in a fortnight.
Exactly. Have fun, everyone.